Okay, thank you. It's a pleasure to speak here. What I'll be describing is joint work with Dennis Sullivan. And he might perhaps think it's premature to be giving a lecture, so if you see, it's a trick I learned from Volodya Falk. If you see him, don't tell him. This is our secret. Anyway, this is joint work with Dennis, and the setup is as follows. So recall that, well, I'll let F sub G super S be a genus G, S at least one times punctured surface. And the main object of interest that we'll be studying is Riemann's moduli space. I'm going to put it down here because it's going to fit into a diagram, which I'll write MGS, Riemann moduli space of this surface F. And as is known, moduli space, or some small variant of it, supports a ideal cell decomposition. And what one would like is an orbifold compactification of moduli space together with a cell decomposition of the compactification. There are compelling reasons for this. So there's sort of a scheme of calculation in physics where a problem of integrating over moduli space could, on this orbifold, be traded for an intersection theory problem, which could be formulated using the cell decomposition, this putative cell decomposition, which could then be solved using matrix models. So there's kind of an imagined machine here. So we seek an orbifold compactification together with an extension of the cell decomposition that's somehow all tractable. And I guess I gave a talk at U of T in September where there's a natural cellular completion of the cell decomposition here. Sadly, it fails to be an orbifold. Now, there's another whole structure that evolves there, and it's interesting, and I mean, it's not sort of a dead horse, but it's not an orbifold. So what I'll describe here is, so again, we want an orbifold cellular compactification. In the U of T talk, I said, well, we have a cellular compactification, you know, darn, it's not an orbifold. Here we have, of course, a well-known orbifold compactification, the Deline-Mumford compactification, which I'm not going to bother to define, really. And can we, in some way, extend the cell decomposition of moduli space to Deline-Mumford? So here's the theorem I'm going to tell you about, brand new theorem. In fact, proof while I was here, as follows. There is a real blow-up of Deline-Mumford, real blow-up. So that's sort of the right-hand side of the diagram. Of course, this has the same homotopy type as Deline-Mumford. And it's not an orbifold, but it's a blow-up of an orbifold. And I guess I didn't quite leave myself enough room here. Together with a new gadget, a new combinatorial gadget. All right, GGS hat. This is, I'm not even sure quite what to call it yet, maybe the stable fat graph complex, stable fat graphs. And in fact, this complex arises from a quotient of, sorry, the notation isn't sort of so clean yet, the quotient of another complex upon which the mapping class group acts. And this quotient gives this stable fat graph complex, and then finally the punchline is, and these are homeomorphic. So I have not succeeded in giving a cell decomposition of an orbifold compactification, but it's sort of the next best thing. I found something homotopy equivalent, indeed a real blow-up, together with a tractable cell decomposition, indeed, that descends from an associated space on which the mapping class group acts. So this is the theorem I'll be describing. This is kind of a long-standing problem to come up with an appropriate orbifold cellular compactification, and maybe a couple further remarks are in order. I mean, when it sort of depends on your religion how you feel about the Deline-Mumford compactification. To an algebraic geometer, as a stack, it's a perfectly legitimate object. There are topologists who don't really even believe it exists as a space. And a corollary of this discussion is, in fact, it's a blowdown of a very explicit simplicial complex. So in some sense, this issue is put to rest with the theory I'll describe. So that's one comment about sort of the general theorem. The other comment about the general theorem is really what's going on is there's something called the decorated Teichmuller theory, which I'll remind you of. And what's really going on is it turns out this theory is renormalizable. So this is really a theorem. I mean, this our discussion today is really a statement that decorated Teichmuller theory is renormalizable. And I'll make all that precise in the course of the talk. Okay, so the talk will be structured as follows. So the talk. Right here. There are really a number of ingredients that go into the discussion. So sort of imagine we are sitting here, and I'm going to go off and discuss what I'll call punctured fat graphs. Punctured fat graphs, kind of a new combinatorial. This isn't sort of the main ingredient. This is just one of the ingredients. Punctured fat graphs. Probably the main part of the discussion is this little arrow that will discuss degeneration of decorated hyperbolic structures. And it's sort of in that arrow that I'll discuss the renormalizability of this decorated Teichmuller theory. Then there will be a little formalism called screening operators, which is a necessary part of handling degeneration of hyperbolic structures. Then there's sort of a discussion of degeneration of punctured fat graphs. And finally, and only finally, is there a discussion of this blow-up of Deline-Mumford. Okay, so I can sort of apologize that there are all these sort of disparate topics. And this is kind of a spherical talk. Talk in the sense that, you know, over on the other side of this sphere is the theorem that I'm aiming for, and hopefully these will kind of converge to at least a neighborhood of the theorem. And in a neighborhood of the theorem, however, there's some examples, and so I'll show you a couple down-to-earth, two-dimensional examples, and you'll see, oh yes, I mean, it's sort of palpable. So in this spherical talk around the theorem, no, it's spherical. So there are some examples that I'll show you at the end. Okay, so here's more or less the structure of the talk, and we'll kind of go around the spokes of the wheel here. All right, so first topic are these punctured fat graphs, and before I can give an exposition on that, I need to recall the fat graph theory and the decorated Teichmuller theory. So this is either a recollection or a quick list of definitions. So I think, let me say the words, and I'll write down as much as you insist I write down. An arc family in our surface F is a collection of arcs, actually the homotopy class of a collection of arcs connecting, disjointly embedded arcs, running from puncture to puncture. So here's an example of an arc family in the torus. The homotopy class, say, of a pair of arcs running from puncture to puncture, not necessarily the same puncture. So that's an arc family. We say the arc family fills F, provided every complementary region is a polygon. In fact, the two arcs that I drew in the torus are a filling arc family. So here we have an arc family filling the torus. And when you have an arc family filling a punctured surface, there is a dual fat graph. And for such, so let's call the arc family, say, alpha. And for alpha, there's a dual, and again, I'll just put it in quotes and then make the draw picture and say the words, a dual fat graph. A fat graph is just a graph in the usual sense of the word together with a cyclic ordering on the half edges about each vertex. And of course, cutting on these two arcs decomposes, rather than draw the fat graph here, let me draw it in a simpler vein. Cutting on those two arcs decomposes the torus into a quadrilateral with opposite sides identified, and you build the dual fat graph by, in each complementary region, put a vertex, and for each edge, put a dual edge in the natural way. So here's the dual fat graph associated with this arc family in this surface. And the cyclic ordering I referred to, the extra part of the structure for a fat graph as opposed to just a graph, comes from the orientation of the surface. Okay, so an arc family in the surface, if it fills the surface, gives a dual fat graph. And an ideal triangulation is a maximal arc family. Triangulation is a maximal arc family. So this isn't maximal. For I could add yet another curve, which is to say, add the diagonal of this quadrilateral, and the dual fat graph in this case would be like this. And so an ideal triangulation is a maximal arc family, and its dual fat graph is trivalent, because in a maximal family, complementary regions are triangles. Maximal arc family and its dual fat graph is cubic. Okay. Good. So there's one more thing I need to remind you of. It's just a definition. And then we'll get down to the kind of meat of the matter, and I'll introduce coordinates. This talk and the techniques for the theorem we're aiming for are largely sort of 19th century. I'm going to analyze an explicit family of coordinates. So in some sense, it's very modest techniques. And, we'll be doing some high school arithmetic, really, to prove the main theorem. Okay, so let me just down here and also recall the decorated Teichmuller space is, if this is the usual Teichmuller space of our genus GS punctured surface, lying over it is a bundle where the fibers over a point are is a copy of R plus to the S, the number of punctures, where the fiber over each point is the set of all S tuples of horocycles, one about each puncture. Syntight. So here the fiber is the set of all S tuples, not necessarily disjointly embedded, of horocycles about each puncture. One about each puncture. One about each puncture. And in some sense, this gadget will be our object of, at least to begin, of coordinates and so on. So, for instance, whereas a hyperbolic structure on the torus, on this marked torus, is a point of Teichmuller space, a point of decorated Teichmuller space is a marked hyperbolic structure on this torus, together with a choice of horocycle, any horocycle. Okay? So here's the decorated Teichmuller space. And again, we're still on the level of recollection. This decorated Teichmuller space admits global real analytic coordinates, on the one hand, and on the other hand, admits a cell decomposition where the cells have their own sort of separate coordinate system. So, again, maybe I will try and put this up and save it. Here are the coordinates that are going to be, we'll be using throughout the talk. So, coordinates. First of all, maybe I start with a picture in the surface. So suppose we have a point of decorated Teichmuller space, hyperbolic surface together with a horocycle about each of the punctures. And suppose I have an arc in an arc family, so a homotopy class of arc running from puncture to puncture. Of course, that arc has infinite length, but the horocycle gives us a sensible way to truncate and get a nice finite length along the geodesic in the homotopy class from horocycle back to horocycle. So it's assigned length, so that if the it's assigned length, and then the basic coordinates are the lambda lengths, which are this funny transform, the square root of twice the exponential of delta. So these are the basic coordinates, and I'm going to explain in a moment that they give, in an appropriate sense, global coordinates on decorated Teichmuller space. So there's the first basic coordinates. There's some associated coordinates. Suppose in a complementary region to one of these arc families, one of these arc families in a decorated surface, I have a triangle. So let me draw that triangle in the universal cover. The various horocycles determine a triple of horocycles, one at each of the ideal points. And let me suppose that the lambda lengths are, say, let's see, I want to do this in a certain way, A, B, and C. Then there's something called the H length, which is essentially the hyperbolic length of this little horocyclic segment. So in fact, it's half the hyperbolic length of these horocyclic segments. Horo segments, and there's a nice formula for them. In fact, the hyperbolic length of half the hyperbolic length of this little horocyclic segment is A over BC. Turns out, we do a calculation. So we got lambda lengths, we have these H lengths, each will play a role when we study degenerations of decorated hyperbolic structures. And finally, and most deeply in the theory, is now let me suppose I have not just one ideal triangle, but two of them meeting along a common edge. So in other words, I have a triangulated quadrilateral sitting in a decorated surface. So at each of the vertices, there's a horocycle. And let me suppose the lambda lengths are as indicated, A, B, C, D, and E. I'm going to associate yet another invariant. And again, this is the deepest of the three, perhaps. The simplicial coordinate. And the simplicial coordinate of the edge labeled little e. Let me just give you the formula. It is the formula that will play the basic role for us. I'll tell you a little bit of the geometry, and then you'll see once we start doing arithmetic that there's somehow some magic in the formula. I mean, the formula has content unto itself. That's what I'll be emphasizing. What is the formula? It's a squared plus b squared minus e squared over abe plus c squared plus d squared minus e squared over cd. At this point in the discussion, you should be saying, who cares? I mean, it's some formula. Maybe let me give a bad but correct description of the geometry here. Maybe the easiest thing to do is to say, under appropriate circumstances, namely if the lambda lengths A, B, and E satisfy all three triangle inequalities, then there is a unique equidistant point to the three horocycles. Likewise, if C, D, and E satisfy triangle inequalities, there's a unique equidistant point. And this simplicial coordinate is just, so you can sort of project those equidistant points down, say, to this horocycle, and this is just the length of the little blue arc. Or equivalently, it turns out, you calculate, is the same as the length of that little blue arc. So this is the length of the blue arc. But that's a bad description. Maybe I give one more. There are several formulations of this basic coordinate. Here's the quickest. The next is, it's well known that the light cone in Minkowski space, the open positive light cone, is naturally identified with the set of all horocycles in the hyperbolic plane. So if you give me a decorated quadrilateral, I have 1, 2, 3, 4 points in the light cone. Those four points determine a tetrahedron, and funny, A, B, C, D, E is the volume of that tetrahedron in Minkowski space. Tetra in Minkowski. But this still, I hope, I mean, shouldn't answer your question why you should care about these. Okay, here are the coordinates and the deep part of this discussion, I mean, the involved part of the discussion, which on the other hand is high school arithmetic, is this little arrow, which is going to require looking carefully at this formula, where you'll see there is some kind of magic. Okay, so here's the theorem. I guess we're back on the level of recollection. I'll get to the new stuff presently, but we're still on the level of recollection from decorated Teichmuller theory. I'll call this theorem one. And theorem one is that fix an ideal triangulation of your surface, then take lambda lengths on the edges of that ideal triangulation. Those give global coordinates for decorated Teichmuller space. Fix an ideal triangulation alpha of FGS. Then, well, there's sort of an obvious map from decorated Teichmuller space to all positive real-valued functions on alpha. Lambda lengths. Then the lambda length function, assign that invariant to this data, lambda length function, is a real analytic homeomorphism onto. Lambda lengths are global coordinates. Is real analytic homeo onto. So there's theorem one. Let me not discuss the proof. We've got a lot of stuff to discuss here. It's not hard. The proof isn't so hard. You more or less go mimic Poincaré's original construction of Fuchsian groups in this very simple case where you have parabolics and are able to prove this theorem. It's not so hard. More difficult is theorem two. And theorem two goes like this. Simplicial coordinates on filling arc families. So now draw a filling arc family in the surface and put numbers next to each edge, and those are meant to be interpreted as these funny invariants, these simplicial coordinates. Simplicial coordinates on arcs in a filling arc family. Filling arc family. And I guess, actually, to make the statement a little cleaner, I'm not going to look at these numbers, but I'm going to look at projective class of them. Take the quotient by the reals, take the projective class of this tuple of numbers, and these give, again, a real analytic homeomorphism between a combinatorial object and Teichmuller space, give a real analytic homeo between what I guess I'll call arc sharp of F. This is the set of all it's the geometric realization of the poset of all quasi-filling arc families. Oh, I realize I'd sort of rather pitch this a little differently. In theorem one, it's an ideal triangulation. In theorem two, I'm going to take the action by the mapping class group. So I'm looking at orbits of arc families that fill. So this is the okay, make sense? In theorem one, we've got a fixed ideal triangulation in this fixed surface. In theorem two, I want to change gears and think instead of a fixed arc family, I'm going to think of mapping class orbits of arc families. Okay? So projective simplicial coordinates on mapping class group orbits of, well, on arcs in a mapping class group orbit, mapping class group orbit. Well, you have a collection of arcs with a bunch of numbers on it. You have a homeomorphism of the surface. Take the image of the arc family under the homeomorphism and just push forward the numbers. So this arc sharp is the geometric realization of the poset of filling of orbits, of mapping class orbits of filling arc families. I haven't said anything yet. So far there's just some funny symbols and a definition. But the point is, and it's the main point, maybe it's the main point of sort of the combinatorial treatment of moduli space itself, is that simplicial coordinates on edges gives a real analytic homeomorphism with moduli space across an open simplex of dimension S minus 1. So here's an explicit, on the left, it's some just explicit combinatorial object. And on the right is this, well, the main character, the thing we're trying to study. So this gives a combinatorial description of Riemann's moduli space at the expense of adding a little open simplex. Theorem 1 is fairly straightforward. Theorem 2 is involved. Maybe you've seen Theorem 2 in the conformal setting, relying on work of deep analytic work of Strabel and Hubbard Maser. There's also a hyperbolic geometry treatment, and this is what I'm giving here. Okay. So on the one hand, lambda lengths give global coordinates. You take these funny transforms and mod out by the mapping class group, and you get a combinatorial model for what is essentially moduli space. Okay, this was still on the level of recollection. Here are the first sort of two new theorems to get us started. We had the notion of an arc family filling F, and we had the notion of an ideal triangulation. I'm going to relax that and allow exactly once punctured complementary regions. So an arc family alpha quasi-fills, quasi-fills, if complementary regions are either polygons, complementary regions are either polygons or exactly once punctured polygons, or once exactly once punctured polygons. So I've relaxed the restriction that arc families fill. And a quasi triangulation is a maximal such.
In the interior.
Once punctured, yes. Once punctured polygon, yeah. And a quasi triangulation, in parallel with the definition of ideal triangulation, is an arc fam, so let's say in four, a quasi triangulation, complementary regions are either triangles or exactly once punctured monogons. For a quasi triangulation, complementary regions are either triangles or exactly once punctured monogons. Okay, so I need to say a little bit more about the combinatorics. This combinatorics will play a role later in the discussion. Just as to an arc family filling the surface, we have a dual fat graph. To an arc family quasi-filling the surface, we have a punctured fat graph. Namely, there was a vertex for each complementary polygon. Likewise, let's do the same thing, and let's have two colors of vertices. One that says this complementary region is punctured, and one that says it isn't. Okay, so dual to a quasi-filling alpha, just in the sense of that board, is a punctured fat graph. Here's finally the promised new material, punctured fat graph, where there are two colors of vertices, namely punctured, unpunctured, and punctured. And whereas unpunctured vertices must have valence at least three, punctured vertices can have any valence. Where the valence of unpunctured is at least three, we don't allow complementary bigons, just as we didn't there, and that's all. Punctured vertices can have any valence. For instance, dual to a punctured monogon would be that picture. Dual to a punctured triangle would be that picture. Make sense? Okay, so there's this, just soup up the notion of fat graph to include punctured fat graphs. By the way, the Euler character, well, never mind. We don't need that, probably. Okay, I need one more definition, and then I'm going to state the partners. I'm going to state theorem 1 prime and 2 prime, extending to punctured fat graphs, this theory. So, given a subset, let's call it P, of the set of punctures, we can consider partial decorations. So we're not going to choose a Horace cycle at each and every puncture. We're only going to choose a Horace cycle at the special punctures. So given a subset P of punctures, we consider partial decorations. Partial decorations, you know, i.e. Horace cycles only at these guys P. Horos only at P. Only at P, and we can consider a decorated Teichmuller space in the same manner as before, a decorated Teichmuller space where you decorate only the punctures, and then it's an R plus to the cardinality P bundle over the usual Teichmuller space. Good. So, here, I guess it sort of fits here. Should allow me to bury that. So, theorem 1 prime, the partner of this, is fix a set P of punctures that we're going to decorate and take a quasi-triangulation based at P. I mean, so that all the arcs run only to P. So fix P 6P, and a quasi-triangulation based at P. Then, again, there are lambda lengths. There are lambda lengths for each edge in this quasi-triangulation, for it runs from a decorated puncture to a decorated puncture. So let me use sort of the same fix, the quasi-triangulation alpha, let me use the same syntax as that. Then the lambda length function, what do I mean? We're going from, I'll call it TGS tilde P, you know, this is the decorated type Miller space, decorated only at P. There's a natural lambda length function to R plus to the alpha. And the claim is this is a real, or the theorem is, this is a real analytic homeomorphism, just like that one. Is real analytic homeo onto. So punctured fat graphs give a basis, if you want. Punctured cubic fat graphs give a basis for partially decorated Teichmuller space. Theorem 2 prime, so that, of course, that's the analog of this. The analog of this is as follows, and sorry for the sort of funny words, projective class, same funny words though, projective class of simplicial coordinates. Aha, there's again a notion of simplicial coordinate here, of simplicial coordinates on arc families, quasi-filling, F, give a real analytic homeomorphism. I'll write it as arc. I'll put a sharp sign, but I'll put a point in the middle to indicate that the complementary regions can be punctured. Of F, this is again the geometric realization of the poset. Same words, except instead of filling, quasi-filling, poset, blah, 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 quasi-filling. So mapping class orbits, and here's kind of the punchline, is that this is isomorphic to moduli space across the closed S minus 1 simplex. So let me sort of explain what we just did. We want to compactify moduli space. We somehow want to involve the cell decomposition. The classical theory gave us only a cell decomposition of moduli space across an open simplex, and our first step towards compactifying is to put in the faces of that open simplex. That's what we just achieved. Vlad, you look like you want to say something. In theorem one, I godlike say these are the punctures that are decorated, and then I give a cell then I give global coordinates. In theorem two prime, I don't care which one, you know, maybe it's this one and this one, or maybe this one and this one, and those correspond to the different faces of this simplex. Here I specify P, here I don't. Yes. The usual. In theorem one. No, the dimension of the dimension of moduli space is not reduced, but the dimension of decorated moduli space is reduced, precisely by the number of punctures that you don't decorate.
But if you remove the grade for one puncture, you remove one dimension.
Correct. And you remove also one arc.
But if you remove just this point, then you remove 3 dimensions.
No, not on the level of decorated Teichmuller. No, I'm not removing any points. All I'm doing is here's an arc family filling this monogon. And now if I want something quasi-filling, I remove one arc. Codimension one for each puncture of it you don't allow. To the punctures in P and only those in P. This is not in P in this picture. Here, this puncture is not in the decorated set. Make sense? But there's a difference, and I'm glad you asked the question. Here, I specify P and get global coordinates. Here, any possible P arises, and that corresponds to the various faces of this simplex. kind of a nice picture. I mean, it's a nice extension of the theory to partially decorated hyperbolic structures. Okay, so there, we just discussed punctured fat graphs. Now we come really to the meat of the matter, the manipulations of these coordinates. And it is here that we shall see that decorated type Noether theory is renormalizable. So, let's try and save that. Move this. And there are two main lemmas that I want to show you, and I'm really going to prove them. This is the meat of the matter, and you'll see that these formulas that are up on the board still aren't just, I don't know, there's already content in the arithmetic. There are two main lemmas I want to show you. One's called the IJ lemma. It explains how decorated hyperbolic structures can degenerate. And the other is the renormalization lemma, which says the theory is renormalizable. Okay? I will prove these two lemmas through a series of little small lemmas of sort of arithmetic. So here's the first such a little lemma. There'll be little lemmas and then two big lemmas. Here's the first little lemma. By the way, sometimes, for instance, in the discussion so far, it's been most convenient to speak of arc families. As we've seen, arc families, whether they fill or quasi-fill, have a dual fat graph or punctured fat graph, and it'll be convenient to just transport the notions from here to here. So I might think of lambda lengths associated to edges. Or I might think of H lengths associated to sectors. Here's the dual triangle to the sector of the fat graph. And likewise, I may think of simplicial coordinates as associated to edges of the fat graph. So here's the little lemma. Suppose, what's the best way to say this? Let me just put it in words, and then I'll show you the proof. Which will make things more precise. Suppose the proof's easy. Suppose that E1, E2, blah, 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 En equal E1 is a closed, say simple if you want, but closed edge path in a fat graph. Say cubic fat graph. Cubic fat graph. Maybe I'll draw a picture. Say like that. Well, when you have a closed edge path in a fat graph, it traverses a certain number of edges, and it also goes through a certain number of sectors. And what I'm going to claim is that there's a relationship between the sum of the simplicial coordinates on the cycle and the sum of the included sectors, right? Whenever you're marching along, you turn right, and then you can record that little included H length. So then, the sum of the simplicial coordinates along the cycle, I put quotes here, because along the cycle, this part doesn't have to be in quotes, along the cycle, equals actually twice the sum of the, and here I need quotes because I didn't give you a definition, but I hope it's clear. There's an included H length whenever you turn. Included H length. So there's a relationship between the simplicial coordinates and the exact. And the proof is just a triviality. There's this little sort of telescoping argument. Here, let me show you. I'll do it here. Oh, I realize. I forgot to tell you something. And it's just arithmetic. Look, the first term here is A over BE, right? That's a H length. In fact, this is a linear expression in the H length. So in fact, why don't I come back over here and do that? Sorry, I forgot to tell you that before. If here we have a decorated quadrilateral with lambda lengths A, B, C, D, and E, and say with H lengths, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, and phi, then the simplicial coordinate is just this linear expression, alpha plus beta, I mean, check with your eyeball, okay, alpha plus beta minus epsilon plus gamma plus delta minus phi. The arithmetic's already on the board and trivial. Agreed? Happy? Okay, so look, this is fun. What's the simplicial coordinate of this edge? It's this h length plus this one minus that one plus that one plus that one minus that one. Let's get a different color. What's the simplicial coordinate of this edge? It's this one plus this one minus that one plus this one plus this one minus that one. Oh, look, those cancel. And these combine. So on a cycle, we just get the sum of the included h lengths. See, just this nice little telescoping property, formal consequence of the formula. Proof, simplicial coordinates in h lengths, telescope. Coordinate telescope in h lengths. Telescope in h lengths. So there's our first little lemma towards the renormalization description. Okay, so the next little lemma is really going to depend more subtly on the formula and is interesting. So given a collection of numbers, putative simplicial coordinates on the edges of a cubic fat graph, let me suppose they're all non-negative, and I'll say they satisfy the no vanishing cycle condition if there is no cycle in the graph, so that all of these numbers vanish. So a collection of non-negative numbers on the edges, let's say, of a cubic, edges of a cubic fat graph, satisfy the no vanishing cycle condition. Well, if there are no vanishing cycle condition, so that the sum of the numbers on these edges vanish. No vanishing cycle condition if there are no vanishing cycles. And here's a little lemma that shows you there really is some content to this stupid formula, more than just combinatorial. Here it is, lemma. Suppose a collection of simplicial coordinates satisfy the no vanishing cycle condition. Then, by theorem 2, there's a corresponding point in Teichmuller space, and there are corresponding lambda lengths. And the assertion here is that then the lambda lengths satisfy all three possible strict triangle inequalities. A little arithmetic fact. This is somehow the crucial point for understanding the degeneration of hyperbolic structures. As follows, if simplicial coordinates have no vanishing cycles, satisfy this condition, then on a cubic fat graph, then the lambda lengths satisfy the three strict triangle inequalities at each vertex. Lambda lengths satisfy strict triangle inequalities at each vertex. This is kind of this fun little calculation. And honestly, you'll see in the when we get to the two lemmas we're aiming for, this is somehow one of the main points. Problems like non-triangle inequalityness propagate assuming the simplicial coordinates are non-negative. So here's the proof. And it's just, like I said, high school algebra. Here it is. It's fun, too. So let's adopt this notation, and let me suppose the triangle inequality fails here. So suppose, for instance, C plus D is less than or equal to E in this notation. And let's just manipulate it. So then, certainly, C squared plus D squared is less than or equal to E squared minus 2CD. Agreed? I built it in. The simplicial coordinates are always non-negative. Let's use the fact that this implicit coordinate is non-negative. So this expression is non-negative. Let me multiply through by little a, b, c, d, e. Those are all positive quantities, so the resulting thing is also non-negative. So 0 is less than or equal to, let me just write it down, cd times a squared plus b squared minus e squared plus ab, c squared plus d squared minus e squared. All right, high school arithmetic. Okay, but c squared plus d squared minus e squared is less than or equal to 2cd, minus 2cd. So this is in turn less than or equal to cd, a squared plus b squared minus e squared plus, or let's say minus 2abcd. You can see we're going to actually be able to conclude something here, because take this inside and conclude that cd a minus b squared minus e squared is non-negative, yeah? But again, C, D are each positive, so this is non-negative. It implies A minus B squared minus E squared is, doing it this way, is positive. And that implies that another triangle inequality fails. This implies either B is bigger than or equal to A plus E, take square, you know, put this on the other side, take square roots, or A is bigger than or equal to B plus E. So the failure of the triangle inequality in this triangle implies failure in this triangle. And that by positivity of this simplicial coordinate. Yep, this simplicial coordinate is positive, which implies failure on this triangle. Which is da-da-da-da. We get a whole cycle of triangles on which the triangle inequalities fail. See? Honestly, you'll see in a moment this is somehow a crucial point for controlling degeneration of hyperbolic structures. So we get a cycle of triangles where the triangle inequality fails. Maybe I'll draw that cycle, and now we're all but done, because there's, again, sort of a little telescoping trick. So there's a cycle of triangles. A cycle of triangles with failure of triangle inequality. With failing. Triangle. Inequality. Okay, so there's a triangle where it fails, say with edges T1, T2, and B1, and then there's another triangle where it fails, say with edge T3 and B2, and, you know, so on. And so the sum of the TJ plus 1 is bigger than or equal to the sum of the BJ plus the sum of the, well, I mean, TJ is bigger than BJ plus TJ. So now sum all these. Well, the sum of the TJ plus 1 is bigger than or equal to the sum of the BJ plus the sum of the TJ. Yeah, but that's equal to that. So this is non-positive, but that's absurd. Lambda lengths are non-negative. Lambda lengths are positive. Contradiction. It's fun. Well, I don't know. Fun. High school. Contradiction. I think it's fun. Okay, so somehow, these simplicial coordinates, the non-negativity of them, is connected with triangle inequality amongst the lambda lengths. Okay, we got a couple more little lemmas, and then I can come to the main lemmas. We're going to try and keep the formulas up. Okay, the next, again, little, I don't know, just little observation, but sort of very fundamental from the point of view of controlling degeneration of structure is as follows. Lemma. Lambda length of an edge times simplicial coordinate of an edge is always less than or equal to 4. So if a lambda length diverges, its corresponding simplicial coordinate must go to 0, is going to be the consequence here. And the proof, well, let's just go back and look at that formula. Again, it's just little arithmetic. Multiply that formula through by little e to get lambda length times simplicial coordinate. And that's a squared plus b squared minus e squared over ab plus c squared plus d squared minus e squared over cd. Oh-ho! Law of cosines. A, b, and e. Oh, I should have said, suppose no vanishing cycles. So the lambda lengths satisfy the triangle inequalities. You got these three numbers satisfying the triangle inequalities. You can build that Euclidean triangle. And in that Euclidean triangle, you can apply the law of cosines and say, gee, that's twice the cosine. And so is that. So it's less than or equal to two cosines. You know, cosine 1 plus cosine 2. Sorry, and there's a 2 missing. So twice cosine 1 twice cosine 2. Anyway, it's less than or equal to 4. Kind of proof. Two more little lemmas. How are we doing for time? Okay, two more. Boris, when do you have to leave? Because I want to make sure to get the two main lemmas in. In 5 minutes? Okay, then let me just state the next two lemmas, which is more of the same. The crucial things are already on the board, the crucial thing being this lemma. So let me state two more little lemmas and then the two main lemmas, which really tell you how hyperbolic structures degenerate. Here are the two little lemmas. So another little lemma is suppose no vanishing cycles. And lambdas, the lambda length bounded below by some L bigger than 1, then the H lengths are bounded above, H lengths bounded above by 2 on L, right, by 2 on L, and again, just from that, from the very this formula, the simplicial coordinates bounded above by 8 on L. So if the lambda lengths are bounded below, the H lengths and simplicial coordinates are bounded above, if there are no vanishing cycles. And then one more little lemma. This little lemma is going to say, in effect, if an H length goes to 0, then both lambda lengths go to infinity, which requires these inequalities that I guess I'm not going to show you. Suppose the vanishing cycles, which is vanishing cycles, lambdas bounded below, again, by L bigger than 1. So if alpha bounded above by some epsilon, so I'm imagining one of the H lengths, I'm imagining in a degeneration a triangle sort of closing like a fan. If the H lengths are bounded above by epsilon, in that notation, if alpha, that A over BC, if A over BC, that H length bounded above by epsilon, then B and C are each bounded below, B and C bounded below by, what is it, a half square root epsilon. Okay, so those are all the little lemmas. Here are the two big lemmas, the IJ lemma, which tell, there's another definition I need to. Here's the meat of the matter, and I need a definition though. So a closed edge path on just on a graph, but let's think of a fat graph, is edge simple if it never twice traverses the same oriented edge. It can traverse an edge twice but not the same oriented edge, and it's not allowed to traverse an edge and then immediately do the reverse. So edge simple if, why don't I just put it this way, here's an edge, and so this is verboten. Well, yeah, I can just put it that way. Twice traversing the same oriented edge is verboten. And also, here's an edge. Traversing the edge and then immediately traversing the reverse is also verboten. Okay, so suppose that alpha is a filling arc family with dual fat graph, say G alpha, then given any collection of arcs, there is a corresponding subgraph of G alpha, namely the smallest subgraph containing all the edges dual to the arcs in A. And we'll say that A, the subset of arcs, is transversely recurrent. Here I'm using some notions from dynamics, which control degeneration, is transversely recurrent, and we'll say GA is recurrent, if through each edge there is an edge simple path. If for each edge of GA there is an edge simple path through it. Edge simple path in GA through it. Okay, so good. So notice that find this notion of a recurrent graph. Any subgraph has a maximal recurrent set, and I'm going to let R denote the maximal recurrent set. Okay, clean board. So any subgraph G in G alpha has a maximal recurrent set, recurrent subgraph, and I'll call that R of G. And now, oh, we lost Boris. I was rushing to try and get the two main lemmas in. Here's the first main lemma. Here's the IJ lemma. And here it is. So imagine a one-parameter family of lambda lengths and simplicial coordinates. And we can take these to be projective coordinates so that the lambda lengths are bounded below. And we can imagine that there are no vanishing cycles for the simplicial coordinates, say for time bigger than zero. And now we can let time approach zero and ask what sort of degenerations can happen. Make sense? I guess now we're not in so much of a hurry, huh, Boris? But so suppose, say, xit for t bigger than or equal to zero is a one-parameter family of lambda lengths, lambdas, on a fat graph, you know, on a cubic fat graph, with corresponding one-parameter family of simplicial coordinates, say capital X I of t, so I indexes the edges, with, all I'm saying is, no vanishing cycles for t positive, and we can ask what happens as t tends to zero. All right, so IJ lemma. Here's the basic lemma that governs degeneration. Let I be the set of all indexes, set of all edges, so that the lambda length of edge I tends to infinity. So this is the collection of lambda lengths that diverge. And let me let J be the set of all edges J so that the simplicial coordinate goes to zero. And here's the basic fact. Then I is a subset of J, and the recurrent subgraph of GJ is GI. So what this says is if the lambda lengths go to infinity, then the simplicial coordinates go to zero. Well, that's a consequence of this little lemma that we actually proved. But more deeply, the collection of lambda lengths that go to infinity are precisely the cycles of simplicial coordinates that go to zero. And that, I mean, another sort of consequence just of this little formula is that GI is itself recurrent. So the picture is you have a fat graph and there's a recurrent subgraph where the lambda lengths go to infinity. And in fact, it's a more elaborate thing because these lambda lengths go to infinity at various orders. So you have a collection of lambda lengths that are finite, and then you have a collection of lambda lengths along a recurrent subgraph that are diverging at the first rate, and sitting inside there, there's a recurrent sub-subgraph where the lambda lengths are going to infinity even faster, and so on. And I'll formalize that a little bit later. Would you get it? There's already something sort of interesting on the board. Lambda lengths diverge along recurrent subgraphs of graphs. This gives some structure to degeneration of hyperbolics, to degeneration of hyperbolic structure. Sure. Lambda lengths go to infinity, simplicial coordinates go to zero. So there's already how do I put it? This is somehow the basic lemma. Let me state one more. So I promised you two big lemmas. Here's one big lemma. I guess I'll omit the proof. The proof follows from the little lemma. It follows easily from the little lemmas that I did prove using the arithmetic here. And here's the other sort of big lemma. Renormalization lemma. And then we'll stop for a break anyway. So here's the renormalization lemma. Fix a fat graph. Fix a fat graph G, cubic fat graph G. And suppose xi are the lambdas, the lambda lengths. And I'm going to suppose there are two basic sizes of lambda lengths, small and large. So suppose two sizes of lambda lengths. Suppose there are lambda lengths with no vanishing cycles, no vanishing cycles of simplicial coordinates. In other words, for positive time, in the sense of one of these deformations. The two sizes are small, and a small lambda length is, I'm going to demand that they're at least root 2, but they're less than some L, which is much less than some other constant K. Those are the small ones, and then the large ones, the XIs, are bigger than this other constant K. Define new lambda lengths, new lambdas, on this same G by... Well, the small ones, don't change them. Small, this xi prime is just xi. Don't change them. And it's going to look weird, but I'll explain it. Here's this basic renormalization procedure is embedded in this next formula. For the large ones, and it's going to look maybe a little strange, xi prime is take the 2 to the 1/4 and then the square root of xi. This is the basic renormalizing map for decorated type filler theory. And I'll explain the geometry in a moment. Let me finish the assertion. So I'll explain why this funny transform in a minute. The assertion is since then there are no vanishing cycles for the new guys. So the combinatorics in the renormalized thing is the correct combinatorics. Then, this is the main statement for renormalization, then there are no vanishing cycles for the new lambdas. What is this map? This map says, well, if some, imagine now we're in the setting of Deline-Mumford, so there's some curve that's getting pinched, and we have the lambda lengths of a bunch of arcs that are hitting it. And the renormalization procedure is to say, consider the natural neighborhood, so-called hypercyclic neighborhood, of this pinch curve, which is symmetric about the pinch curve. In other words, take this length to be the same as this length. In other words, take the new lambda length on this side to be the same as the new lambda length, the new hyperbolic length over there to be the new hyperbolic length over there. Imagine that as you pinch a curve, it breaks these long guys in half. Well, if the hyperbolic lengths go by one half, the lambda lengths go by this transform. So here's the renormalization procedure for hyperbolic geometry. And all you're saying is, when you pinch, it cuts these long things in half. Below, you look a little puzzled. This is maybe one of the main punchlines. Here is the renormalization procedure for hyperbolic geometry. I'm imagining one parameter family of lambda lengths. And I'm imagining a one parameter family of decorated hyperbolic structures, and I'm imagining that some of them are going to infinity. Indeed, I'm imagining in this renormalization lemma the simplest case that some of them are small, that the ones that are going to infinity are all kind of going to infinity together, two rates. There's the finite ones and the ones going to infinity. Then this renormalization lemma says, take the ones that are going to infinity and apply this square root transform. Then the fat graph, the combinatorics in the limit is what you're expecting to see. And I'll explain the combinatorics in the... Correct. On both sides, and the crucial point is that they have the same length. And then the point is the combinatorics is well behaved. So this, the context makes sense. I'm imagining a degeneration of hyperbolic structure. Well, some lengths are going to infinity. Gee, from the IJ lemma, we know they're going to infinity along a recurrent subgraph. And now, in effect, this renormalization lemma says, on that recurrent subgraph, take square roots of lambda lengths. And then on that recurrent subgraph, that's the correct combinatorics in the limit. I've just described for you degeneration of hyperbolic structure. This is sort of the main point. The rest of the talk, we'll take a break and then I'll continue if you want to hear more. And there's more to say about the combinatorics, but this is the geometry. So again, I think there was one sentence I wanted to insert. Well, I guess it's just that degeneration of hyperbolic structure is governed by the IJ lemma, and it says hyperbolic lengths go to infinity along a recurrent subgraph. The renormalization lemma says there is this geometrically natural renormalization procedure so that the recurrent subgraph is itself the correct combinatorics for the renormalized lambda length. So I've now described, Barry here. I've described to you degeneration of decorated hyperbolic structures. And you see, the techniques are just arithmetic. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing, the techniques are just arithmetic, but the results are, anyway, of consequence. So, shall I continue after, should we take a break and I continue, or? Okay, so let's do that, maybe. Okay. Good. Hi.
You're saying here, for example, that you can triangulate this just as simplistic point to triangulate.
Yes.
So this is not going to change, right?
Sorry, which? I mean, if I triangulate the other way?
Yeah.
No, that's not true. This coordinate? No, it does change.
Okay. How could it be then the...
It's a sine volume of the tetrahedron. It's a sine volume of the tetrahedron, where the sine is, so you normalize this triangle so that it's flat, and then, in fact, it changes by a sine if you triangulate the other way. Exactly. It changes by a sine. Yeah. Hey. So, yeah, see you. Have a good trip. It was nice starting an office with you. Okay. Okay, see you. I'm sorry, you were...
No, I was saying, this choice, I guess, comes up in... all the calculations somehow.
Choice, what do you mean?
I mean choice of...
See, there isn't really a choice. Let me explain. The open positive light cone is identified with the set of all horocycles. So if you have a decorated hyperbolic structure, you uniformize in Minkowski space, you have a Fuchsian group acting on Minkowski space, and in particular on the light cone. So now use this affine this duality and put, you get this discrete set sitting in the light cone, and you take its closed convex hull. The closed convex hull, all of these coordinates will be non-negative. So, in fact, it's canonical. That's why, I mean, in this theorem 2 and theorem 2 prime, this is a canonical decomposition of decorated Teichmuller space or decorated moduli space. Yeah. You don't make a choice.
What if IJ lemma is the recurrent subgraph is the later thing in this compactification thing?
I'll explain that in a little more detail after. But I mean, it just says that if on the recurrent subgraph you take these lambda lengths, then there's still some issues because you may, when the recurrent subgraph might have two edges agglomerated into one edge. So you seem to have two lambda lengths before you.
Mm-hmm.
I'll argue in the second half that you get the same number, so there's a well-defined lambda length. But then those lambda lengths give non-negative simplicial coordinates with no vanishing cycles, and therefore give that graph as the correct combinatorics. That's precise.
Well, what do you mean?
So what I'm saying is, if you take those lambda lengths and interpret them as a decorated hyperbolic structure, and if you pull to the light cone and take the convex column, the graph you get is that graph, the one that you started with. And I want to have a cigarette. Come with me. You come with. There's probably a bunch of out there who have cigarettes.
No. Look.
I hope it wasn't too much material, but let me just recap. We have this very naive 19th century point of view that there are these coordinates. We have a cell decomposition of moduli space, and we're imagining degenerations within a cell. And a degeneration within a cell is governed by these two lemmas, the IJ lemma, which I just evaporated here, which says lambda lengths go to infinity only along recurrent subgraphs. And then we have the renormalization lemma, which says, in effect, on one of these recurrent subgraphs, there's an explicit procedure for altering the lambda lengths, geometrically natural, so that there are no vanishing cycles, so that the recurrent subgraph is the correct fat graph for this decorated structure. And maybe it's also worth saying, and it's surprising, that in a degeneration of decorated hyperbolic structure, there's a decoration. You actually get this sort of well-defined decoration. After all, there are lambda lengths, and it's described, well, a partial decoration anyway. It's going to turn out there's sort of several things that can happen, and I'll analyze it. It may be that you just pinch a curve here, and so somehow these lambda lengths are going to infinity. So I guess what I'm saying is, suppose the recurrent subgraph is just kind of a cycle. Then you don't get a decoration on either side, and we're in the setting of the theorem too. You get a partial decoration on the component stable surfaces. Let me continue. This will become clear. This part will become clear, I hope, in the course of this, because I'll describe that combinatorics in a moment. Okay, so we have, I wish I'd left those on the common board, but let's go. We have these two main lemmas, the IJ lemma and the renormalization lemma, all following just from the arithmetic. Okay, so following Fulton McPherson, let me organize the degeneration of lambda lengths into what Fulton and McPherson call nests. So following Fulton McPherson, given a set, for us the set will be the set of arcs in a filling arc family when the time comes, but given a set X, a nest on X is a collection, let's call it calligraphic A, of subsets of X, so that given two sets in this calligraphic A, either they're disjoint or one is contained in the other, or the other is contained in the one. So this is the notion of a nest. Again, following Fulton McPherson, we'll say a nest A is proper, so it's calligraphic A, is proper if, sort of a mouthful, but here it is, we can take a set A in calligraphic A, we can look at the collection of all subsets of it. And let's look at the collection of all proper subsets of an element A of calligraphic A. Now we can take the union of all those, that's a subset of A, and we can demand that that's proper. And so this is supposed to happen for each A in A. The point is, proper means at any stage you look at the stuff lying below it and the union of everything below it is a proper subset. The idea is going to be... No, proper means not the whole thing. Possibly empty. I'm not sure what the... This doesn't have anything to do with sort of full subgraphs. This is a statement of... Look, it's just... No, it's just a statement about sets. Here's what I'm trying to model. Here's what Fulton McPherson are trying to model. You have a bunch of quantities, and some of them are going to go to infinity. Proper means not all of them go to infinity. And nest means you've got some of them that are going to infinity, and within those you have some of them that are going to infinity faster. And within those you have some of them that are going to infinity still faster. That's all I'm trying to model. That's all that's trying to be modeled here, is keeping track of rates at which things diverge. And properness more or less comes from the fact that lambda lengths and all this stuff are projective coordinates, so there's always a least one. And then you look at the things not comparable to the least one. That's the first layer of the nest. And those things are all going to infinity, but maybe some of them are going faster to infinity. That's the next layer of the nest. Dot, dot, dot. Okay? So but this is all sort of well understood and, you know, classical from the, whatever, 80s or something. This notion of a nest and a proper nest. Here's the new hook. Is given an arc family. So now I'm going to specialize these notions to arc families. Given an arc family, say, alpha, filling the surface, a screening operator, here's what we need, screening operator, is a proper nest so that each family of arcs is, well, or its dual graph is recurrent. So a recurrent proper screening, a recurrent proper nest is a screening operator. A screening operator on alpha is a proper nest A so that each, let's say A in A is, well, transversely recurrent in that sense. You know, i.e., GA is recurrent. So now the picture is we have a fat graph, we have a recurrent subgraph, and then a recurrent subgraph of that, and a recurrent subgraph of da da da. That's a screening operator. Sure. screening operator. It screens the rates at which things go to infinity. It's a screen in the sense of I see that may be confusing terminology. Okay, so the IJ lemma, here was the sentence that I was looking for at the end of the last. Here's the point. Degeneration of decorated hyperbolic structure is governed by screening operators. Precisely what the IJ lemma says. It says, the lambda lengths are going to infinity along a recurrent subgraph. And then perhaps to infinity still faster along a recurrent subgraph. Precisely the content of the IJ lemma. The content of the renormalization lemma is that, okay, you have these lambda lengths let's take the simplest case of just a recurrent, where the screening operator has a single set in it, so a single subgraph. Then the renormalization lemma says, so you've got a bunch of lambda lengths that are finite, and then you've got a subgraph where the lambda lengths are going to infinity. Take their square roots. Then that subgraph is the correct combinatorial cell for those renormalized, those square root lambda lengths. Okay? All right. So I think I've told you what is a screening operator. We're working our way around here. And I'll finish now remember there was a diagram where we had moduli space sitting inside Delene Mumford blown up to this gadget, isomorphic to the graph complex, this stable graph complex, which descends from something on the level of Teichmuller space, on which the mapping class group acts, and I'm about to finish the description of this. Okay. Well, I guess when I save him. End him. So let's discuss degeneration of punctured fact graphs. In other words, we have a graph and a recurrent subgraph of it, and we're imagining the lambda length is going to infinity on the subgraph, and we can ask what the combinatorics of the limit is. So here's degeneration of punctured fact graphs. And this is what, Valoja, you were just asking me about a second ago, and I said, wait a minute, and I'll explain. There are various cases. Depending on the recurrent subgraph. So let me show you the various cases. There are five cases. Four of them correspond to the recurrent subgraph being a cycle, and one of them is the more general case where it isn't a cycle. So here's the first case, and you'll see that we already are going to kind of land in the category of punctured fact graphs this way. Suppose you had a boundary, there was case zero, or case one we'll call it, case one. Suppose you have a boundary cycle, and suppose here's the recurrent subgraph, I need some color, and suppose here's the recurrent subgraph. Yeah? Perfectly legitimate recurrent subgraph. It's a boundary parallel cycle. That's case one. And you imagine taking all of these lambda lengths to infinity. Well, that corresponds to simply taking this horocycle and running it all the way off until it disappears. So once that horocycle disappears, you lose the decoration on that puncture, and now we get this punctured fact graph. In the sense of the first part of the talk, the very first part of the talk. So here's the simplest case, is a boundary cycle being the recurrent subgraph. And you get this punctured fact graph. Make sense? This is more or less what we discussed at the very first topic, the first spoke of the wheel. Case two is, well, this boundary cycle, now sort of in the setting, we see that punctured fact graphs arise, might have punctures on it. So now I'm imagining a recurrent subgraph as a cycle, but that cycle has punctured vertices on it, which could happen. And in this case, you sort of split off this recurrent subgraph, you take the edges incident on it and glue them together into a single new vertex, which has a puncture, and you say, oh, that puncture is supposed to be identified with that boundary component. Below you, you look happy? I'm imagining the lambda lengths on the yellow stuff going to infinity. That's a closed loop, just as here, and it's even boundary parallel, but this time it happens to have punctured vertices on it. Okay, like I said, there's five cases. Four of them correspond to cycles, and one of them corresponds, and then finally the more general one. Case three, the recurrent subgraph may be a cycle without punctured vertices and not boundary parallel. So this is the one that I was mentioning to you a second ago. So what does that look like? Well, we have this cycle. We have some edges. Notice I'm drawing them all as cubic now, and I'll address what you have to do more generally in a moment. So it could be, I don't know, let's take, say, this example. Let's do three on one side, three over here and two over there. And here's the recurrent subgraph, again, in yellow. And in this case, you agglomerate these three into a single new punctured vertex. You agglomerate the two on the other side into a single punctured vertex, and you record that those two punctures are to be identified. So, I now told you precisely what you do in this case, and indeed you don't get a decoration on this puncture in this case. Case four. And then finally, the typical case. Case four is you might have a non-boundary parallel cycle, and it may have punctured vertices on it. And so again, now this is the recurrent subgraph, and it's sort of just what you'd expect. You agglomerate those into a new punctured vertex. You agglomerate those into a new punctured vertex. You have this circle. The circle has two, you know, the corresponding fact graph has two boundary components, and you code that each of the punctures is identified with one of those boundary components. Okay, so finally the general case, case five, is the general case. Maybe I just draw it this way. So over on this side of the picture is a recurrent subgraph, not a cycle. A recurrent subgraph that's yellow over there. Yeah? And those are the lambda lengths that are going to infinity. It's not a cycle anymore. No, it wouldn't be... This is the generic picture. This is the correct picture because a subgraph, a recurrent subgraph, always has a boundary in the graph. And I'm drawing a boundary component of the recurrent subgraph, which is to say, if this guy was also going to infinity, then the circle that I'm drawing would be a different circle. This is meant to be a boundary component of the recurrent subgraph of the graph. Okay? Just the boundary. This time the recurrent subgraph is not a cycle, and this subgraph has boundary components, and here's one of them. And what you do is what you'd expect, this is maybe the most interesting from the point of view of renormalization, is you agglomerate those two into a single punctured vertex. You leave the other guy alone. You're going to take square roots of the lambda lengths, and then you code that the puncture and the boundary component are to be identified. So this is what I was alluding to before. Remarkably enough, in the renormalization lemma, well, in several of the cases, but in particular in this case, you get a decoration. This, you know? Case three, the recurrent subgraph is just this cycle. Case five, the recurrent subgraph is this cycle and some other stuff. Everything over here is in the recurrent subgraph. To the right of the cycle that I drew.
You mean the cycle?
I mean, correct. This is a boundary component of the recurrent subgraph. So you have a fat graph and a subgraph of it. The subgraph has a boundary component. I'm drawing one of those boundary components. Right. But it will still have a boundary component. Think of it. Fatten the subgraph and fatten the graph. You have a surface sitting in a surface. The surface has a boundary. The subsurface has a boundary component. I don't know the usual stratification procedure in this context. You mean in what setting? For the standard model or something? What do you mean? There is no. This is new business. This is not. This doesn't have an analog in Deline-Mumford. This is new. In Deline-Mumford, you would just pinch a curve. And there's no structure, there's no nothing. The structure that remains is the hyperbolic structure on the components. But here we're learning you get not only hyperbolic structure on the components, but at least sometimes, and I'll argue later that it's enough, a decoration on those components. This is new turf. This isn't Deline-Mumford. No, the decorations. Maybe we talk about it later. Yeah, because time is really fleeting. I think again, my goal. I guess maybe I'll do this privately for anyone who's interested. Let me finish trying just to describe this piece of the diagram, and we're almost done. So let's look at a particular case here, because there's a little more than meets the eye. I mean, I swindled you a little bit because the renormalization lemma would say, okay, on all the yellow arcs and all the yellow edges, take the square root of the lambda length. And in particular, I put in a little intermediary picture. Let's concentrate on one of the cases, say case 5, that this discussion is the same for all the cases. But we kind of lose some edges. But really, you know, you want to imagine this thing, and then the yellow stuff, what was yellow, but there's still sort of a vertex there and a vertex there. Right? When I take the square roots of these diverging lambda lengths, I get one lambda length there and another lambda length there. How do I get an intelligible picture, an intelligible lambda length on the final picture? Well, the lambda lengths satisfy triangle inequalities, as I proved for you. So if this number, this lambda length, and this lambda length are diverging, and these three numbers satisfy the triangle inequalities, then the ratio of those two numbers goes to 1. A little estimate. Yes, just triangle inequalities. So this lambda length is equal to that lambda length, and that's the number you put on here. So this renormalization procedure really gives you well-defined lambda lengths. Make sense? And I'm using the triangle inequality here one more time. But here's the point, and then I'll put the example up on the board. There's more data. So the lambda lengths, using the renormalization lemma, nicely give you an appropriate decorated hyperbolic structure. But there's more data. The more data is, we have the simplicial coordinates as well. Okay, these yellow lambda lengths are all going to infinity, and therefore, each of these simplicial coordinates is going to zero by the IJ lemma. However, these two, or the, you know, these various simplicial coordinates are going to zero possibly at different rates. So what we do is we blow up, here's the final blow up, and then I can draw a picture for you. We finally blow up by, for each boundary component of the recurrent subgraph, a contractible, it turns out, complex that records the relative sizes of the simplicial coordinates going to zero. So I just, you know, parenthetically, I'm telling you the renormalization procedure requires the whole theory. It requires lambda lengths, which behave very nicely. You know, you get well-defined lambda lengths, but it also requires the simplicial coordinates to get a sensible complex, to get a sensible complex. get this complex G hat. So let me, at this point, show you some examples. Sure. You have a, yes, and they're organized along along a screening. They're organized by a screening operator. Yes.
And you kept two blocks, one on the original graph and one on the smaller graph. So we can say about the block of what taking square root is the math.
Taking square root. Okay, so you'll see when I put an example up, is that the faces of the simplices in the decomposition are described, well, kind of as usual by collapsing trees, but now also by recurrent subgraphs. And the square root map tells you how to glue the higher dimensional cells onto the lower dimensional cells. The square root map is the gluing map in the face structure, in the boundary structure. Let me show you an example. Make sense? I mean, Okay, so. And then I guess maybe we'll stop. It's late. And anyone who wants to see the Delene Mumford part of it, because I haven't described the blow up here at all, and I will privately if anyone wants to see it. We've got one here. Okay. Hang on. You got to flip that. Whoops. Careful. Okay. Actually kind of funny, the example. Whoops. Well, maybe this one has, this is the one that has to do. Okay. What's the simplest moduli space? For a thrice punctured sphere, and the moduli space is a point. So here's my blow up of that point. This is what one gets upon blowing up that single point. So let me explain. So and as usual, for decorated pairs of pants, you have three horocycles. And mod out, take projective classes, we get something two-dimensional. And the usual two-dimensional picture has a theta when the three decorations satisfy the triangle inequalities, and then three other top-dimensional cells. And, for instance, when the simplicial coordinate on A goes to zero, this theta pinches down to this curve, to this graph, this fat graph, and then when it pulls out the other way, so doing a whitehead move on A, you pass from this cubic fat graph to this cubic fat graph, yeah? So somehow this face is the one we're used to. These three faces are the ones we're used to. However, now we're going to have additional codimension one faces for each recurrent subgraph of the theta. And there are exactly three recurrent subgraphs in the theta. There's, you know, this one, and this one. And those correspond respectively to these three. Well, not sure respectively. They correspond to those three faces. For instance, who is this? Contracting, so the recurrent subgraph corresponding to the cycle AB is this punctured fat graph. Now, we're used to fat graphs describing cells. In fact, in this context, they describe subcomplexes, and the subcomplex associated with this fat graph, this punctured fat graph, in fact, in this case, does have dimension one. It is in fact just a simplex, and the parameter along here corresponds to the ratio. Remember, A and B, their lambda lengths are going to infinity, so their simplicial coordinates are going to zero. So we have these quantities capital A and capital B, each of which are going to zero. We still have one real parameter. namely A over A plus B. And as that goes from, where's A, 0? That goes, when A is 0, you're at this side of this sub one of the simplex, and when A goes to 1, you're at this side of the simplex. So I hope, you see, I've described all of the codimension 1 faces of this cell. Let's see, we can, sorry, that's wrong, so let's look over here, say at this guy. What are the screening operators on this barbell? Well, there's, what are the faces of this barbell? Well, there's this one as usual, and then what are the new ones? Those correspond to the screening operators, and there's exactly 2 screening operators, that one and that one, which correspond to those 2 codimension 1 faces. And again, there's a, when we shrink this recurrent subgraph, when the lambda length on there goes to 0, there is again a 1 simplex depending on, what's the parameter here? It's the ratio of B and C. A is going to, well, I can cheat. Over here, hang on one sec, I'm confused. Pardon me?
What's wrong?
I'm just having, well, what's wrong is I'm having, what's the one remaining parameter? Because after all, associated with this recurrent subgraph, I seem to be drawing this one simplex. And so the one parameter, I guess it's B over B plus C. Yeah, I guess it's B over B plus C. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, you're right. It's B over B plus C. And then it's B, and then if B goes to 0, yeah, exactly. It's B over B plus C. Exactly. So, I mean, I hope this example makes some sense. You see these punctured fat graphs together with partial pairings of the punctures with either other punctures or with boundary components correspond to subcomplexes of the blown up complex. It's the same, I think of it projectively. I show you one more example, just because this really, I mean, you, I don't know. Here we blew up a point and got this thing. Now let's look at the once punctured torus, where here is the picture. And of course, what we're used to is one top dimensional cell, and we can collapse any one of the 3 edges to, as usual, get any one of the 3 classical faces. This graph, again, has exactly 3 recurrent subgraphs, so there are 3 one-dimensional new faces, this one, and this one. They're one-dimensional for the same reason as before. There's one parameter corresponding to the projectivization of the remaining simplicial coordinates. And so here's the picture just of a fundamental domain. You want to imagine, you know, a bunch of these at each ferry point. And here sort of is the blow-up of Deligne-Mumford. This is meant to be kind of like a zipper. The usual single smooth point on Deligne-Mumford is actually blown up into a one simplex. This one simplex. Namely, the quotient of this one simplex by the appropriate mapping class group. It's kind of a cute picture. That single point, the ideal point in the Deligne-Mumford compactification, is replaced in this context by a one simplex. This one simplex. It's just as before. Take the recurrent subgraph here. Collapsing one edge, you get the 3 usual faces, and collapsing 2 edges, collapsing 2 edges, in other words, taking a screening operator corresponding to this recurrent subgraph, you're left with this punctured fat graph. These 2 points. Because there's a parameter when A and B go to, when lambda length AB go to infinity, there's still a simplicial coordinate, capital A and capital B. And so there's a parameter, A over A plus B, simplicial coordinate over, normalized simplicial coordinate on A. which goes from 0 to 1, which goes from 0 to 1. And that one parameter in simplicial coordinate space is the gives rise to the one parameter on the blow-up of the ideal point. Make sense, Leo? The parameter is the ratio of the simplicial coordinate. The fact that this is has one the fact that this is a one simplex.
Yeah, but where is this one this precise diagram?
Here?
No, very important theorem that this subgraph is needed to
for. Here. Where is it encoded here?
Yeah.
It's not. That's the point. Punctured fat graphs are not names of cells, they're names of complexes. And in this case, the complex happens to be a one simplex. And the coordinate on the one simplex is given by this A over A plus B. This is a little different from the usual context. A one simplex plus two vertices. Yeah. And indeed, those two vertices are identified because there's a symmetry of the torus of this fat graph that flips A and B. And change the orientation. I mean, this is the order two, the hyperelliptic. Yeah. Correct. For instance, here that one parameter family is given by the ratio of the simplicial coordinate. You know, A over A plus B. That's the one parameter along there. As I was saying before. Okay. Well, I hope you believe me. Let me pull this up. I didn't describe the right-hand side of the diagram at all. There is an explicit new kind of graph complex where the cells where the subcontractible subcomplexes are indexed by punctured fat graphs together with partial pairings of the punctures. And I've sketched for you that has something to do with Delaney Mumford, right? I just haven't told you what the blow up is. But maybe I can tell you in a couple words or as you wish. Maybe we call it a day in a couple words. Okay. There are a million questions. What happens to the Vig-Peterson 2 form? What happens to the combinatorial classes? Look, I proposed sort of a machine. At the beginning of the lecture, I said there should be a machine where integration becomes intersection, becomes matrix model. You know, there should be a machine for calculating things. And there are now a million questions to try and apply this to. Another good question that I think should be interesting, let's try and figure out a matrix model. Of course, we know the Euler characteristic of Delaney Mumford, and therefore we know the Euler characteristic of any blow-up of it, but I think it sounds like a very interesting project to figure out a matrix model for this new combinatorics that's arisen. Yeah? I mean, you could, as part of the machine that I was alluding to. Seems to me there are a million things to do now. So, Kintaro, let me just quickly explain this part. In fact, it's done in two steps. The first step, maybe I'll call it m hat. The first step is, okay, we have a stable curve. So there are a bunch of curves that are being pinched to points. Now, we're going to put not screening operators, but proper nests on those. So now we're going to keep track of the rate at which these curves are being pinched to zero. But there's a sort of a hook. There's a constraint that comes from the combinatorics here. Notice I'm allowed to pair a puncture with a puncture, and I'm allowed to pair a puncture with a boundary component, but I'm never allowed to pair a boundary component with a boundary component. And that constraint in the geometry is manifest in this blow up as follows. That's neat. So we've got, imagine we have a stable curve. We're keeping track of the rate at which the pinch curves are going to infinity. And now imagine yourself standing in one of the components of this stable curve. And you look around, there's a bunch of punctures, and there's sort of a biggest puncture, meaning the largest torus cycle, then there's the next, you know, there's the first order infinity puncture, and then the next order infinity puncture, and da 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 da. Yes? So here's the constraint. So again, we're keeping track of the rate at which things are pinching to zero. Now we stand in a component and we say, let's look at the largest torus cycle. And I demand that it never happens that this thing is largest on this side and largest on this side. It precisely corresponds to the statement that a boundary component in the stable fat graph can't be paired with a boundary component, turns out. So this M double hat is a union of affine spaces, one affine space for each proper nest on the pinch curves, satisfying this condition. Okay? So now, make sense? We got the affine space being the relative sizes of the largest torus cycles. And now there's a lemma you have to prove. It's not obvious that this is a blow-up. You have to show the fibers are contractible, but there's a little separate argument that says this constraint doesn't introduce any topology. Okay. This first blow-up makes sense? We're going to keep track of the rates at which things are going to infinity, and there's a constraint. The constraint is it never happens that a given cusp is largest on both sides. And you have to prove a little lemma that says fibers here are contractible. And now we're back in the context of the beginning part of the lecture. So for instance, if you pin, then what? Then it can't be largest. Then there must be, and indeed it wouldn't be. There would be a puncture. I mean, in the case of the torus, if I pinch this curve, then this torus cycle is of finite length. This is going to infinity, and it's fine. So, in the pinched surface, in this component, this guy would be largest, and that's cool. Okay, so that's the first blow-up, but now this is really fun. So, now imagine we're at a point here, and we've got a stable curve. We've got this partial decoration on each component surface subject to this constraint. Well, according to theorem 2 prime, we get a cell decomposition based at the largest punctures. Precisely what theorem 2 prime said is that if given a partially decorated surface, we get a combinatorial decomposition. We get a corresponding punctured fat graph. So in each component surface, we get a punctured fat graph corresponding to the partial decoration that we imposed in this first blow-up. And now the second blow-up is the same as the second blow-up I did, the blow-up that I, the last, the final blow-up that I did here. Namely, having applied this construction in each component surface, you know, we either have it's exactly the same combinatorics here. Either we've got to blow up a puncture to a decorated puncture, or we've got, you know, it's exactly these cases. And again, you check that in each case that the choices are contractible. The arc complex of a punctured polygon is a ball. And so on. In each of these cases, you check that the final blow up that I did before. That I did before is contractible. And then, make sense? So there are these two stages of blow up, one to decorate, and now you've got a partially decorated surface, and you've got to sort of explain how to glue the two pieces together. And it's the same blow up we did at the end here. And that's how you build M hat. And it is, you know, what I did really give you, like, the sketch of the proof is of the morphism. It's sort of clear now that these are isomorphic. A screening operator, you look at there's an induced proper nest on the boundary components, da da da. I mean, this part is almost a triviality now, armed with the IJ lemma and the renormalization. Okay, thanks.
Together with a little more data in order to get something that has a tractable self uplink. I mean, that's really what I did. You have to imagine that you have these two component surfaces, and on one of them, the horocycle is infinitely small compared to the point of view of the other side.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't. The canonical decoration isn't useful here. You really need to put in these screening. You need to put in these.
No, I want to say that why canonical.
Well, and there's more to say too. Hang on. The combinatorics of the cell decomposition depends not only on the conformal type, but also on the decoration. And then you have no guarantee, in fact it won't happen, that as you degenerate structure and use the canonical horocycle, the canonical decoration, that in the limit the combinatorics behaves correctly. This is the whole point of the renormalization lemma, is that the combinatorics behaves correctly.
So you mean that, you know, the original suspicion is, I know that canonical
decoration.
Decoration is bad, but I want to convince myself once more. So the idea is that, you mean that if you shrink...
Then the combinatorics goes to hell. You have this graph, you have this recurrent subgraph, and when you finally pass to the limit, the cell decomposition of that subsurface isn't the one that isn't that graph. It's something different.
Well, what do you think about going to lunch?
I think it sounds like a marvelous idea.
Yeah.
Why don't you show me after?
Well, what's
Leo, show me after, okay?
What do you think about?
No, come on, there are many people waiting. Show me after. Show me after. I mean,
no, no, just on me.
Anyway,
what do you want to say? That in principle, this
you see the problem. The problem is
the
problem, which is solved by the renormalization lemma, mm-hmm. is that the combinatorics, as you degenerate, you a priori have no control over. And the renormalization lemma says the combinatorics that you want to see is the correct combinatorics.
Yeah. Yeah. Understand what you do. The thing that I would like to understand what's wrong with canonical thing.
There's no reason to expect that the.
But you have no explicit counterexample, whatever.
No, I mean we could just screw this up. Mm-hmm. You know, let's see. I mean, I don't have one off the top of my head. We could do one.
Yeah. Okay. Because in principle, you have static optimization of every stratum.
Yes, but they don't fit. You don't have boundaries.
But the question is whether they
don't have gluing. You don't have gluing maps of the cells map to cells. That's precisely what the renormalization is.
Yeah, I see. Look, Lily.
Okay.
Yeah. Come on, let's get lunch.